Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. So think about this, folks. Just imagine if you could get away with just printing out a checkbook of any company that you want to get even with them, you know, because they're just really have done you wrong. You an absolute injustice. And you can actually start writing checks and you get away with it. As a matter of fact, you go around and everybody just believes that you have the authority. You convince every time, and let's just say you have this gift. You have a gift of tongues where anytime anybody tries to challenge you and basically tries to, you know, come after you, all you have to do is say, I have the authority. And that instantly just, I mean, they stop in their tracks and they go, this person has the authority. It doesn't mean that the checks that you've been writing and the money you've been spending on your own behalf means that it's legitimately done. In other words, you're going down the path of writing checks. Again, this is hypothetical, but you're going down writing checks at your own benefit to basically create harm to some corporation or company that you're really not an agent of, but you have you just have this power, this gift of being able to get away with it. Now, just imagine that. Just imagine if you can actually, you know, imply the authority that you don't have, and you convince all sorts of other evildoers to work along with you. Next thing you know, you get to a point where you can only buy yourself so much stuff. So you say, hey, friends, family, come on, I have a checkbook. Let me write you stuff. I mean, there are people that will do that. And there are people that just to cause the harm to that corporation you just want to get even with. So that is exactly what we're dealing with. Now, it's not that they're trying to get even with us. It is the fraud of trying to destroy us. And they're trying to do this, and they're right out in the open. This is kind of the amazing thing. One of the things I was commenting about to a candidate that was running for a statewide office is because I referenced them to downsizinggovernment.org. I think that's a Cato Institute website, whatever. But anyway, I referenced them to go there because they were talking about, you know, dealing with cattlemen associations and real estate and builder associate. In other words, and actually the conversation in the bigger picture, the conversation was really about, you know, who are the real grassroots activists? Because it seems like, especially on the Democrat Party, and I'm not sure where you live, folks, but if you go out into the red states where they have parades and county fairs and that type of stuff that's, you know, is really, really popular out in the very rural states, the flyover states, let's say, you're going to find that the Republicans are out and they're in numbers in these parades. And so the Republican Party seems to be an existing party grassroots. But here's the thing. You won't find Democrats at these same fairs, at these same functions, even though they may have people running on the Democratic Party. You will not find a Democrat attending these fairs. They just don't have, I mean, In contrast, in the numbers, you may actually have a few people, but they just won't be in the numbers. And that's because their grassroots are really the radical grassroots, when you really look at where their numbers are in the grassroots organizations, it's Black Lives Matter. It's, you know, La Raza. It is these real radical organizations, and they're out recruiting people to work with them to support electing really radical people. Now, on the flip side, on the conservative side, even though you do have the Republican Party and there's people out there knocking on doors and so forth, as a matter of fact, over the past, you know, actually for my entire life, I've lived in conservative areas, and I've never had a Democrat knock on my door asking me to support the Democratic campaigns or anything like that. But I've had Republicans, and I've had, you know, conservative organizations trying to, you know, get out the vote. So all that being said, when we look at these, let's just say we look at these other conservative organizations like the Cattlemen Association, like the some agricultural groups and so forth. When we look at them, why is it that they're not united, and why is it that they're not just feeding in and supporting? It's because they're trying to make sure that they get a candidate that is going to give them what they want, which benefits them at the disadvantage of others. In other words, when we really look at the conservative side, it's not like they're all working together for the champion of the Constitution. On the other side, in contrast, we know that the leftists are all supporting the most radical person they can possibly get. And there's nobody on the radical left side that would never cast a vote because that person's just not their type of radical. Unlike on the conservative side. So when you look at the conservative side, we already know, because in the 2012 election, and I've covered this before, we know that there are conservatives that will refuse to vote for another kind of conservative, such as a Mormon, you know, or for religious reasons, for a Catholic. And so we have a long way to go, and I'm not sure if we're going to get there, because as long as we allow ourselves to be divided, and so here's the thing, we keep on focusing on what benefits us and our organization. And actually, in talking to this gentleman who's running the statewide race, I said, you know, if you can get a chance in talking to the cattlemen's, the realtors and so forth, I mean, if you can get them to say, well, let's be honest, right? Let's be honest about your organization. The realtor organization or the realtors association, whatever they are in your state, you're going to find that they are quiet when it comes to the invasion. Why? Because as long as there's a huge demand, and as long as there's this increasing demand on real estate and the selling and transactions of real estate, they benefit. So they're not going to say anything. They, as a matter of fact, if you tell them that we're going to stop the invasion and repel these invaders, which would actually cause a glut, it would create a surplus of inventory, to a point where there would be less people buying and there would be far less demand, right? When you have this overwhelming demand and a lack of inventory, the prices just go up. It is a big win for realtors. And bottom line, I told this gentleman to say, you got to poke them in the eye and say, you're a part of the problem. The same thing with the cattlemen, same thing with agricultural groups, same thing with all of these groups that are seeking advantages for themselves at the disadvantage of others. So, we just want you to support our bill. You can support their bills too, but you have to support us to give us, and as far as I'm concerned, they are a part of the problem. They don't realize it, but I understand it is human nature to always seek benefits for yourself, but when you finally realize what you're doing in the big picture, When you're asking for benefits from a government in a system that is not designed to create benefits for anybody, then what you're doing is you're actually causing, or you're directly contributing to our demise. So let's start to be honest. Let's actually, you know, take that big step and say, why is it that we can't unite? And so here's the point. And as a matter of fact, it's so good to see, because I saw a correspondence this weekend that went from an organization that I've been working with and been getting them to utilize these pledges for candidates to say, if you want me to basically endorse you, you have to sign this pledge, and you really have to actually prove that you're out to support the Constitution. So they sent this correspondence out to a candidate that has yet to really make that commitment. They want to have the latitude to impress the world and impress their constituents on how well they can compromise in making things work. And that's not their job. Their job is to support the Constitution, and when we have all of these things that are violations, it's not about creating a new compromise. It's about getting into compliance. So I'm here to tell you that, you know, there's good. I see good, but we have a long way to go, folks. We have the blood on our hands. We've got to stop seeking benefits at the behest, you know, for ourselves, or actually at the disadvantage of others. You know, there's only so much of that pie. And as a matter of fact, that pie is not something for distribution. That pie is for something specifically delegated. In other words, when you got to realize that the reason we're paying all of this astronomical taxation is because they're spending money on things they have no authority to do. This includes your state. This is why your state is becoming insatiable in property taxes and all the rest of these taxes. The federal government's come along and saying, you got to buy into these programs. You got to spend to do these things. And, oh, we're going to give you some money, but you have to basically sign the stipulations and with these strings attached and do exactly what we tell you to do. Now, near as I can tell, the federal government doesn't have the authority to even create those types of demands on the state. But they say, oh, well, if you take the money, then you are obligated to do what we tell you to do. They don't even have the authority to write that type of contract. And everybody runs scared when they see that, oh, well, we took the money and we've got this contract. The Constitution constrains them from being able to do those things. And they're getting away with it, just like the fraud. And so hopefully this kind of helps. If you could write checks, you know, for your own advantage, to either harm somebody or to do harm, and get away with it because you had the ability, the prowess, or what have you, you've bamboozled people into believing you have that authority, it still doesn't make it legitimate when the contract or the powers delegated have never been delegated to give you that ability to write money for those things, to take on loans for those things. It's that simple. I mean, folks, the beauty of our system is literally the simplicity of the compact. And so this is why we have the new color-coded Constitution, and it should be up right now. It's not up as I'm recording, but it should be up by the time you hear this recording, because this color-coded Constitution will give you the enumerations in a color code. So when you read what kind of enumeration, is this a power? Is this a property? Is this a role or responsibility? Is it a standard? Is it some jurisdiction, criminal jurisdiction? we spell out every little thing, every line, every clause in the Constitution. We highlight it. So when you look at it, you go, oh, this is not a power. This is a responsibility that they're supposed to do. But it's not something that they can inflict upon us. This is something that they're supposed to do for us. In understanding the Constitution with that type of context, you will actually realize the power of attorney that the contract really is. It's a limited and specified, not a general power of attorney. In other words, if you considered the contract or the Constitution, the compact, in the mode of a power of attorney, where we, the people and the states and our sovereign states, have delegated very specific and limited things within that Constitution. They can't possess land. They can't even possess and control mineral rights. That's left for the states. All things not delegated within that compact are left to the states and the people respectively. And if the states don't have mineral rights, then guess what? The mineral rights go to that those people who actually have that land. And folks, I'm just here to tell you that they don't even have the power to withhold land from you if you buy it. In other words, I'm not sure if you know, but they've been playing these games for so long that you think you own the land, which is why and how they tax you over that. If you are a freeholder of land, you can't be taxed. Now, unless you actually have that in the Constitution, in other words, in your state constitution, when they started assuming the ability to tax, that needed to be specified, that the state would obtain its revenue based on these types of taxes. And folks, I'm here to tell you that unless it's enumerated at the state level, the county level, or even the federal level, they can't do it. They just can't assume that they can do what they need to do. They can only do those things that we've delegated to them to do. Unless you made the mistake to say, well, do whatever you want. And I'm not aware of any constitutions that say that, but I wouldn't put it past California and some of these other states where people were dumb enough to say, yeah, your government is so good, please just do what you want to us. We're here for you. Anyway, okay, so before I get into the augmentation of the ratification debates, I was listening over the weekend to a Biden ad, and the Biden ad was basically calling out Trump as a felon who is just out there, you know, do you want to vote for a felon who's out there serving himself? Or do you want to vote for Biden who's out there fighting for the American family? Now here, I'm telling you folks, when I heard that, I about got sick. Now, what Trump should be doing, I'm just giving you, a quick 2 cents in engaging in the current campaign. If anything, Trump should actually be calling out Joe in response to these ads and basically say, Joe Biden owes the American family, the American family, you know, parents and children, not people that, have this weird concocted relationships. Absolute families where two people have created, a family of children and so forth. And so he should be apologizing for the invasion on the southern border that's causing this housing crisis. He owes them an apology for the increasing costs, the inflation of the currencies, the fact that they can barely get by economically. I mean, he owes the American family apologies in so many different ways that I think Trump should have fun with it. Where's the apology for the fact that, Biden has actually stepped on the American family and actually is promoting the non-traditional family, which is a destructive element that it's historically the traditional family is the nucleus of every society. The nucleus of every society. As a matter of fact, these aren't my words. These are Ludwig von Mises' words in his Treatise on Socialism, where he talks about how important the family really is. And I'm here to tell you that Ludwig von Mises was kind of agnostic. He was not Christian. But at the end of his life, he was thankful that he lived in America, and he was thankful for America being a Christian nation, because he realized that the best blessings come from Christianity and a Christian nation, where you have the greatest amount of liberty. Now, it's one thing to be able to go out and do what you want to do, but to create laws to protect you and to basically shut down opposition and to attack people that you don't like, that you don't want to tolerate anymore, that is not the land of liberty. And that's not coming from the traditional families and good Americans. It's coming from the radical left tyrants who want to silence their opposition. And it's only getting worse. And we're seeing this in our court systems. We're seeing this in every facet of our society. So, folks, if he really wants to start leveraging, all he needs to do is just listen to anything that Joe Biden says or his campaign is saying, and he can easily turn that against Biden, because Biden has been the nemesis of the American family, and he owes us an apology. And as a matter of fact, you know, I would even have fun with it. I would just start going out and getting all sorts of people from all over America saying, yeah, you owe me an apology. And actually, I would even create a YouTube channel, Make America Great Again or what have you, or just create your own online video to where everybody could actually, you know, create their own rants of how they are far worse off after 4 years of Biden, or almost 4 years of Biden's administration. You could have fun with it. But anyway, let me dive into, and I got about 2 minutes left before we go into the break, but let me dive into these ratification debates. These are Massachusetts ratification debates. And I want to cover things like uniformity. I want to cover new states' admissions and those types of things as we go through this. Stuff that I've not really focused on. I've just kind of focused on jurisdiction, powers, you know, some of the real basic stuff out of the ratification debates, what we're covering now. And so I've taken some time and I've actually looked for some new things. And in this particular case, we're still in the Massachusetts ratification debates in the augments here. And what we're going to do is we're going to cover Mr. Gore, and he's going to kind of talk about uniformity and autonomy. And this is what he says. He says, observed in reply to Mr. Holmes that it had been the uniform conduct of those in opposition to the proposed form of government to determine in every case where it was possible that the administrators thereof could do wrong, that they would do so, although it was demonstrable that such wrong would be against their own labor and interest and productive of no advantage to themselves. On this principle alone, they have determined that the trial by jury would be taken away in civil cases, when it will have been clearly shown that no words could be adopted to apt the situation and customs of each state in this particular. Jurors are differently chosen in different states, and in point of qualification, the laws of the several states are very diverse, not so less in the causes and disputes where they're entitled to trial by jury. What is the result of this? The laws of Congress may and will be conformable to local laws in this particular, although the Constitution could not make a universal rule applying to the customs and statutes of the different states. What he's basically saying is that they need to go down this path of creating kind of a common ground on the common cases, that they have this responsibility to be able to provide appeals and to be able to deal with the appeals coming from different types of states. And in other words, if they were only one way, they could only deal with a certain type, then those appeals would have a hard time plugging into that form of court and law. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Now, he's going to use this there's an upcoming Latin phrase, and so I just want to kind of be clear here when we hit this. Anyway, as he goes on and he says that the laws of Congress may be conformable to the local laws in this particular, although the Constitution could not make a universal rule equally applying to the customs and statutes of the different states. Now, I had to read that because I had to kind of rush and I barely made it into the break. But anyway, then he goes on and says this: very few governments, certainly not this, can be interested in depriving the people of trial by jury in questions of meum et tuum. And basically, meum et tuum is a situation or a case of mine and thine, or an express rights to property. In other words, this is mine and this, then that's yours, or this is mine and not yours. So anyway, so he basically says, especially in these specific rights of property. In criminal cases alone, are they interested to have trial under their own control? And in cases, the Constitution expressly stipulates for trial by jury. But then, says the gentleman of Rochester, Mr. Holmes, to the safety of his life, it is indispensably necessary the trial of crimes should be in the vicinity, and the vicinity is construed to mean the county. This is very incorrect. The gentleman will see the impropriety by referring themselves to the different local divisions and districts of the several states. But further, said the gentleman, that the idea that the jury coming from the neighborhood and knowing the character and circumstances of the party in trial is promotive of justice on reflection will appear not founded in truth. If the jury judge from any other circumstance but what are the parts and the cause in question, they are not impartial. In other words, he's pointing out that if everybody has a bias, they, whether they like this guy or dislike this guy or woman, whatever, this person, if they know them that well, then they may not be as impartial as they need to be to actually administer justice. And as a matter of fact, we have witnessed in America where justice has gone out the window because of biases. Because if you have a, you know, the makeup of a jury, when we're talking about a racially divided issue, the makeup of that jury is racially divided in one particular way or the other, we will actually see racial biases instead of justice. And so the great object is to determine on the real merits of the cause, uninfluenced by any personal consideration. If, therefore, the jury could be perfectly ignorant of the person in trial, a just decision would be more probable. From such motives did the wise Athenians, so constitute the famed Apergus and I guess that's an old court of Athens, that when in judgment this court should sit at midnight and in total darkness, that the decision might be on the thing and not the person. So in other words, they wouldn't see. In other words, they'd be blinded by no visibility. Further, said the gentleman, it has been said, because the Constitution does not expressly provide for an indictment by grand jury in criminal cases, therefore some officer under this government will be authorized to file informations and bring any man to jeopardy of his life. An indictment by grand jury will be disused. Now, let me ask you this, folks, because my wife and I, my beautiful bride, we've been watching reruns of the old, old cases of Law and Order. And when they talk about infamous crimes, they were following the book that they would go to the grand jury to get an indictment before that person could be charged and you know, arraigned and tried. And so when you look at the Constitution basically states that no person is to face an infamous crime unless they've been indicted by a grand jury. And so we've kind of been cutting the corners as a nation to a point that I don't hear or see any grand juries operating for these infamous crimes that are absolutely being charged and people are being tried. In other words, if you've actually gone to trial for murder and you've, you know, basically you've faced a capital or a life sentence where you're giving up, you know, life to stay in jail, what have you. My friends, if you did not have the indictment, I mean, I don't want to get rid of people and let them get, you know, go free, but the Constitution requires that there be a grand jury indictment before that person faces a trial. Why is it that we're seeing these corners getting cut? because it's more expeditious, they save money, the court makes more money instead of having to spend money on a grand jury. Isn't it in the wash, though, when we realize, you know, how the court works? Doesn't that just increase their charges if they have to actually spend more money to do the same thing or to do the things that they're supposed to do? Anyway, let me move on. If gentlemen who pretend such fears will look into the Constitution of Massachusetts, they will see that no provision is therein made for an indictment by grand jury or to oppose the danger of an attorney general filing informations, yet no difficulty or danger has arisen to the people of this commonwealth from this defect. If gentlemen please to call it so, if gentlemen would be candid and not consider that whatever or wherever Congress may possibly abuse power, they certainly will, there would be no difficulty in the minds in adopting the proposed Constitution. And so this next one is kind of a Saturday, Mrs. Dalton, and he talks about, and this is just a really quick blurb, and this is about Confederalism. And so, again, this is Mr. Dalton, and he says, said we had obtained a great deal by the new Constitution. By the Confederation, each state had an equal vote. Georgia is now content with 3/8 of the voice of Massachusetts. So he's basically talking about this new Confederalism, where there's not pure equality. In other words, when it comes to representation in the House of Representatives over those laws that fall under the roles and responsibilities of the House of Representatives, there's not an equal representation in Congress. So the point is, there is an equal representation in the Senate. But the point he's making is the representatives of the people of Georgia would be, what did he say here? 3/8 of the voice of Massachusetts based on the new Constitution. how is it that the people of Massachusetts wouldn't see that, hey, you know, they're being given the proper representation in kind to Georgia? Because why should Georgia have an equal say in one chamber of Congress when it's to represent the people? It shouldn't be equal. It should be representative and apportioned by its population. And that was the brilliance of the design. That was the brilliance of this. This is not federalism. This is confederalism, where each state has this autonomy, where each state has these, I don't want to call it uniformity, because there is the uniformity across the spectrum regarding the Senate, but there is a level of more accurate representation over those matters that matter to the people, like going to war. See, if Georgia had an equal weight, they wanted to go to war, where that would actually cause more people from Massachusetts to have to go to war. Because remember, we already covered this, that because Georgia was a slave state, they would not be able to send as many people. Therefore, they would rely heavily upon the northern states. And so if they all had equal stay or equal assertions, then they would actually be able to declare war with equality, where it would require basically just a number of states instead of a number of representatives. Case in point, when you're looking at, you know, the representation of the states, they're not equal. So this is why when we look at the control of the House of Representatives currently, because the red states are less populated, we would need more than 25. We'd actually need a total of 27 states to have enough representation to control the House of Representatives. What am I talking about? On the Senate side, you only need to have 26 states to have control. 25 is even, right? Because it's two senators per state. So when we're talking about the state legislature saying we want to obtain full control over both houses of Congress, you actually have to take account that the House of Representatives is not an equal, you know, an equal layout. It's not two per state. It's based on apportionment and population. Now, when you look at the blue states happen to be heavily populated. New York, California, and so forth. And so when we look at the layout right now, it's about 27 states. And this is based on my numbers as I was looking at it about 2020. I don't think it's changed much. It could be 28 now. I don't know. But actually, because of 2020, there was a reapportionment. And I honestly think it's still 27 because California lost 11. Let me say that again. California lost 11 representatives, and the majority of those representatives lost went to red states. Illinois, I think, gained one or two, and New York, I think, gained one. But the repository, or the remaining, the majority of those 11 actually went into red states. So what that means is that there was kind of a shift, that more control of the House of Representatives has shifted towards red states. Why is that? Because based on the citizens, they're not even abiding by this, but you know, I'm going down a rat hole. Based on the 14th Amendment, Section 2, that apportionment for representation is based upon U.S. citizens. Because Jimmy Carter, it's his brother, because Jimmy Carter and his administration, he actually changed the apportionment in direct violation of Section 2 of the 14th Amendment and has started counting illegal aliens and giving them apportionment, and the Supreme Court has gone along with this. This is where the Supreme Court has actually redefined the Constitution, saying anybody and everybody, you don't have to be a U.S. citizen to be, you know, guaranteed the rights and privileges and immunities of the Constitution. And clearly, the Constitution actually states that the privileges and immunities cannot be abridged of U.S. citizens. It doesn't say anybody living in the United States. It only protects U.S. citizens. And so I know I just went down and opened up probably a couple different rat holes here, but the reality is this, that when we're looking at confederalism, confederalism is how the states have a level of control. Because of the bicameral representation in the Senate, the House of Representatives is based on population of the states, and the Senate is based equally, two senators per state. Hopefully I've kind of backed out and cleared up the mud here. But I believe that what Mr. Dalton just said was a very illuminating point, that they were moving away from the Articles of Confederation, which guaranteed each state equal voice across the board. In this new Congress, it created a bicameral legislative body that basically provides different types of apportionments and representation in both of the different houses. That the House of Representatives was based on population. There would be one representative for every 30,000, and each state in the Senate would have two representatives of the state legislature. So anyway, hopefully that's as clear as mud. The next one is Mr. Sedgwick, or the Honorable Sedgwick, and this is kind of regarding Confederalism, Army, militia, and so forth. This is January 24th, and he goes, quote, "We went into a general answer to the objections which had been started against the powers to be granted to Congress by this section. He showed the absolute necessity that there was that the body which had the security of the whole for their object should have the necessary means allowed them to effect it. And in order to secure the people against the abuse of this power, the representatives and people," he said, "are inequally subject to the laws and can therefore have but one and the same interest, that they would never lay unnecessary burdens when they themselves must bear a part of them." I'm going to pause right here, and I'm going to go back to what he's saying, because this is basically stating that if Congress passes a law that creates a burden that you have to pay into Social Security, that you will be drawing on Social Security, that they must bear that burden themselves. That's what he just said. I'll say it again here. "Therefore, have but one and the same interest, that they would never lay unnecessary burdens when they themselves must bear a part of them." Right? So as we kind of look at, you know, the fact that they're not actually abiding by this, this is why the ratification debates are so important. Because there's nothing in the Federalist Papers that ever alluded to the fact that Congress could immune themselves from, you know, these types of laws that they created for the people. This is clearly another enumeration in the ratification debates that point out that there is this uniformity that is required. Now, anyway, let me move on. And he says, "And from the extent of their objects, their power ought necessarily to be illimitable. Men," said he, "rarely do mischief for the sake of being mischievous. With respect to the power in this section to raise armies, the honorable gentleman said, although gentlemen had thought it a dangerous power and would be used for the purpose of tyranny, yet they did not object to the Confederation in this particular power. And by this, Congress could have kept the whole of the late army in the field they had seen fit. He asked if gentlemen could think it possible that the legislature of the United States would raise an army unnecessarily, which in a short time would be under the control of other persons. In other words, because every 2 years they get reelected. In other words, they have to behave or we get rid of them. And we've actually seen that. Whenever there's been wars, we've actually seen a kind of a significant turnover so that we actually start shaping our policies to go the different direction. If this is why it's always been important to get the people behind going into war. It always helps when you get attacked so that everybody is ready to get their pound of flesh, like 9/11, December 7th, and so forth. Anyway, he moves on and he says, he asked if gentlemen could think it possible that the legislature of the United States should raise an army unnecessarily, which in a short time would be under the control of other persons. For if it was not under their control, what object could they have been raising it? It was said a chimerical idea to suppose that a country like this could ever be enslaved. How is an army for that purpose to be obtained from the freemen of the United States? They certainly, said he, will know to what object is to be applied. It is possibly said that an army could be raised for the purpose of enslaving themselves and their brethren, or, if raised, whether they could subdue a nation of freemen who know how to prize liberty and who have arms in their hands. In other words, he's talking about the natural defenses that we, the people, have arms, that we, the people, are the army. And even though they may call up some to federalize into a formation of a federal army, that doesn't mean that the rest of the people who didn't get called up, you know, have to surrender their guns and actually become pacifists. No. He said it was a deception in gentlemen to say that this power could be thus used. The honorable gentleman said that the Constitution, every provision against an abuse of power was made, and if gentlemen would candidly investigate for themselves, they would find that the evils they lament cannot ensue therefrom. Okay, so now the next one is kind of regarding the federal town or the District of Columbia. This is from the Honorable Mr. Davis, and he said it was necessary that Congress should have a permanent residence, and that it was the intention of Congress under the Confederation to erect a federal town. He asked, would Massachusetts or any other state wish to give New York or the state in which Congress shall sit the power to influence proceedings of that body, which was to act for the benefit of the whole by leaving them liable to the outrage of the citizens of such states? In other words, when you think about it, if the federal government was sitting in the state and was under the umbrella of a state, then they would create a symbiotic relationship which would create a huge advantage for that state, because that's how politics works. You know, they become akin because they are adjacent, or actually they're, what do you call that, commingling, and that commingling creates a perverse relationship in respect to the rest of the states, which is one of the reasons why it had to be autonomous. Now, the next one is Mr. Ames, and this is Friday the 25th, and this is regarding the empowering of the Confederation. Mr. Ames said that in the course of the debates, gentlemen had justified the Confederation, but he wished to ask whether there was any danger in this Constitution, which is not in the Confederation. If gentlemen are willing to confederate, why, he asked, ought not Congress to have the powers granted by this section? In the Confederation, said Mr. Ames, the checks are wanting, which are not found in this Constitution, and the fears of the gentlemen that this Constitution will provide for a permanent aristocracy are therefore ill-found, for the rulers will always be dependent on the people, like the insects of a sunshiny day, and may the breath of their pleasure be annihilated. The one thing that changed everything here, you got to remember that the Bar Association, or this elite society that was created by the British Accredited Registry for our legal system, as they exported their legal system into America with these supposedly standards, these academic standards from Britain, as they started creating that, that's how they created the aristocracy. But to be clear, the 13th Amendment and the people of America saw this happening, which is why the 13th Amendment was ratified in 1812 regarding the nobility clause, and basically laid out that any person that would become an esquire within the Bar Association could not be a citizen, nor could they be a public servant. In other words, if you want to be a lawyer operating under the bar, you could not be a U.S. citizen. You'd have to give up your citizenship. Doesn't mean you can't be an inhabitant, and doesn't mean you can't operate in the court. You just can't vote, and you can't do all of the other things that a U.S. citizen would enjoy. And as a matter of fact, I'd have to bone up on the 13th Amendment. It actually may state and require that those people actually be deported. I don't think it did. I don't remember that. But I do know that if you are an esquire in and you are a member of the bar, that is an emolument. That is a title. And therefore, it's a foreign title. And therefore, you would have to surrender your citizenship. If you actually understand the 13th Amendment, anybody that serves a potent, a foreign potent, such as a sovereign, like a religious sovereign, that you are actually under the laws. Now, see, we have a harmony between Christianity and the laws of the Constitution. However, when we look at Mohammedan and the the Hadiths and the laws of Sharia law and so forth, those laws go beyond and actually violate the rights of other people. And it subjugates other people, which is why it cannot be congruent or harmonious to operate Sharia law or Mohammedanism in America. That those people that have that faith, that cling to that faith, they cannot be U.S. citizens. I'm sorry. I mean, don't kill the messenger here. The reality is, if you have a direct conflict and you want to compel people to do things that the government cannot possess, you know, we actually have to amend the Constitution to say we can create this form of theocracy and outlaw your ability to eat and sell and possess pig products to eat and so forth, and all the rest of these types of laws. Is subjugating women, that women can't, date, they have to cover all of those types of things. To rule that way in America does not agree and is not in congruence with our Constitution. It is in a direct conflict. And that's one of the reasons why the framers absolutely called out the fact that we do not want to have a theocracy in America. We want to have the liberty of people to choose for themselves. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.